this episode of Comedy Rewind. Does any 90s comedy have a better ensemble cast than The Big Lebowski? What makes The Dude such an iconic character? Is Steve Buscemi ever going to win the Steve Buscemi Sparkplug Award? All of this and more on Comedy Rewind.
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 Push rewind. I thought this was a comedy show.
What's going on, guys? Welcome to Comedy Rewind. We are powered by Audio Technica and 8bit.net as we rewatch the great comedies of the 1990s. I am your host, John O'Peck, and joining me, just back from shopping for a new rug, we got 8bit's own Sammy Deej and special guest, DJ Payne. How you doing?
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition is in.
Yeah.
Sure. Very good. Sure very did. Good.
Thank you very much for having us in the studio, DJ.
My pleasure. I hope as we're recording this, there's a whole bunch of different noises around the studio, so apologies if there's any bleed going over there.
Great. Now I can't edit it out because then people are going to be like, oh, what about noises? I was listening for the noises, didn't hear nothing.
That's all good. So we are, of course, at the 96.3 radio studio, DJ. For listeners who aren't familiar with you from past 8-bit appearances on It Is What It Is and putting in work, you are a breakfast radio host.
I do breakfast 5 days a week, Monday to Friday, 5:30 to 9:30. Join me on 96.3 FM.
Way too early.
Everyone's hanging for the phrase.
Okay.
Today's Christian music. Ooh. That's going to get everybody excited. My credibility has just jumped up. You know, street cred has gone through the roof.
You get street cred on this show because you're the old guy. You're the resident old guy. You were here for the 90s in very much fully formed fashion.
Yes.
Unlike Sammy Deej, who, I don't know, what year were you born? 91 or something?
93. So I left when I was 6 years old.
Holy moly, you were born in 93?
Well, yeah, I mean, like, I feel like this is going to be weird, me being on the podcast for Comedy Rewind, because it's just like, I didn't see any of these theaters. I didn't see any of these till like 2 years ago, kind of thing.
This is good though. You give a fresh, you know, millennial look at things, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So we are talking about The Big Lebowski today. Yeah. The Coen Brothers 1998. Is it a crime comedy? I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's the most intellectual one. So I can understand why you brought me on and Mr. DJ, so we can have this, you know, nice philosophical conversation. You know, we had Dumb and Dumber, now we've got, you know.
Yeah. I'm so excited. I'm just going to put it out there. This is one of my most favorite films. It'd be in my top 5 to 10 films of all time, full stop.
Damn.
I've seen this film a lot over the years, and getting ready for this, I found it a really great excuse to watch the new 4K edition rescan over and over again. So I am so excited. I love Coen Brothers. And this is one of my favorite Coen Brothers films. And I saw this in the cinema at the Village Geelong in 1998.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was the most striking scene in 4K?
Actually, you know what? You can read out, you can read a lot of the text.
Okay.
Like, for example, I noticed for the first time, we're going to get really nerdy really quickly.
Right.
When the dude is on the floor listening to his Walkman on the cassette tape cover, it has, you know, the bowling sounds that he's listening to. And it says in little scribble that I've never read before, side two, Bob. And then later on we have him listening to Bob Dylan.
Sure.
So it's the same cassette that he's listening to.
You are a nerd.
Yeah,
I see that now.
Yeah.
Yes.
Great. Well, that's an interesting way to come into this, I guess, as you being how old in 1998?
I was, we really put him on the spot.
Yeah, we're going to date him right now.
We have to.
I was 24 years old.
Okay.
I had my own photographic studio in the middle of Geelong. And I would often, when I was quiet in the afternoon, didn't have any shoots on, I would literally walk a couple of blocks over from James Street where I was to the Village and sit in the cinemas and watch some great movies. Yeah. Especially around 1998 was my peak watching movies at the Village. Yeah.
Okay. That's a lot older than I was. I was 98, 10 or 11 years old.
I was like 5.
And my early memories of this film is like, I didn't actually watch it until I was probably in uni. It was probably 2006 because we all know it as a cult classic. It's not the kind of movie that would have got played on, you know, Saturday Channel 10, you know, 5 times a year, like Billy Madison or Wayne's World or something.
Yeah.
So it was only through like people referencing it in media and
the cultural osmosis of it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. People referring to it as like this classic comedy that you have to watch, and eventually being, okay, let's see what this is all about.
So watching it like that for you two, this is what I'm fascinated about. Having that baggage attached to it, you know, did it live up to the hype?
I think so, yeah. I think it's pretty obvious why it's so beloved.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't think I had that much attached to it because I think off the top of my head, the two things that I can think of that I might have seen it at beforehand, and I guess, you know, we'll be coming back to this topic a little bit later, is like just like a Seen It game on my phone, and also a few YouTube videos that are just like how philosophical it is, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right. So when was the first time you saw it? It must have not been.
I think probably the first time I watched it in full would be not that long ago, like 3 or 4 years ago, maybe. Wow. Like I kind of had a phase of like, oh, I want to watch like 100 movies in a year and review all of them, and I got to like 60, and I was just like, wow.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. That's done. I mean, that's great.
That's more than one a week.
So. I mean, I watched like two of my least favorite movies ever. I watched Pixels, which is great because I'm going to have to rewatch that for my podcast. Sorry. But yeah, that was amongst them. And I mean, you know, it is a pretty interesting, absurdist kind of comedy kind of thing. It's a little bit kind of crazy like that. And yeah, I kind of appreciate that. Even though, you know, I'm kind of, I don't know. It's a weird mood to be in because like I'm just like, oh no, all these authority figures are getting the man down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting because like you can't really be a film buff of any level and not know the Coen brothers, whether it's Fargo or the work that they've been doing more recently, like True Grit and Are they No Country for Old Men?
Do you want me to read out Do you want me to read out the
Hell
list?
High Water. Oh,
okay.
Yeah, you want me to read it? Go for it. Go for it, DJ. You obviously want to.
No, I'm literally just pulling it up right here. Okay, so this is what they've directed. We'd know them from Raising Arizona, Miller's Crossing, Barton Fink, Hudsucker Proxy, Fargo, and then after Fargo, their next film after Fargo was Big Lebowski.
Mm-hmm.
So I had only seen the Fargo, Raising Arizona, and I might have seen Barton Fink at that time. And so when I saw that they had a new movie coming out, and it's so weird to be thinking I was alive in 98 and the new movie Big Lebowski was coming out, I was so excited to go see it. But then they followed up Big Lebowski with Oh Brother Where Art Thou, Man Who Wasn't There, Lady Killers, No Country for Old Men, Burn After Reading, A Serious Man, True Grit, etc, etc, etc.
Yeah, so a lot of really big and well-loved movies. So it's very possible that a lot of people, I guess, of our age could have got in through the back door that way, where I was like, oh, the Coen brothers, let's go back and see what they've done before.
I mean, they're such a cultural touchstone as well. You know, like one of my favorite tabletop RPGs is a one called Fiasco, and it's always like, we're making a Coen brothers film, but it's like a game kind of thing. It's like,
oh, wow.
It's so cool that they've kind of, you know, carved out this awesome little niche for themselves. Yeah.
And
over the years,
TJ, was it something different for them to do something that's mostly a comedy at this point?
Well, Raising Arizona was a bit of a wacky film. This one, for me, I remember enjoying it a lot, but walking out and going, I don't know what I just saw. I don't know. That first viewing I had in 1998 in the cinema, I loved every minute of it, but it was so surreal to me. But I knew, I walked out thinking, I'm going to have to watch that again.
Yeah.
And so when it came out on VHS, watching it over and over and over again on that and DVD, et cetera, et cetera.
It's very plot heavy in some ways. Like it's not essential to enjoying the movie by any means, but there is a lot to follow in twists and turns. And
yeah, but as the Coen brothers have said in many interviews about it, they've said, look, it's a very detailed plot that means absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
It's
inconsequential.
Yeah. It reminded me of like The Great Gatsby. Like it's all this crazy stuff happening around this person who has no idea what the hell's going on.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what makes it so different. Cause it does kind of feel like a Coen Brothers movie, but just told from someone who's almost completely irrelevant to the plot and yet is so completely tied in it.
Yeah, it's great.
So for me, I think this was probably my introduction to Jeff Bridges. And it's funny because this is just what I associate with him now, not realizing that he had this like 30-year career of like Academy Award nominations and all this stuff. Like this whole pre-goatee Jeff Bridges, and this is essentially how he's been seen and recognized since then is the look that he has in this movie. I find that really interesting.
Yeah, he was like a leading man.
Yeah.
He was like
really
this
really handsome, like super handsome.
Yeah, yeah. Heartthrob leading man at the time. And so this was a really big left turn for him.
Yeah.
And he made a big deal. Like, he was like, how am I going to work out? You know, he's used to getting physically fit for roles and everything like that. And they're like, no, we want you to have... Like, this is the original dad bod, you know, type of thing. You know, he let himself go for this one. And it's funny, to this day, his family, especially his children, said, out of all the movies you've done, Dad, this one is actually you. This one's the most like you in real life.
That's funny.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because he, if you want to feel self-conscious, Google, like, young Jeff Bridges. Devastatingly handsome.
Yeah, he was.
But it's funny you say that it's so him, because apparently Coen Brothers, and you'll know this, DJ, based the Jeff Lebowski character on a producer in Hollywood called Jeff Dowd, who was very similar to the character of the dude played by Jeff Bridges. So there's three Jeffs in play here, being Bridges, Lebowski, and Dowd.
Mm.
And it's interesting just to see that there are pretty much everyone in the movie seems to be based on someone that they knew.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the Coen brothers do that a lot, like literally getting an idea for a movie from one story that somebody tells them. Mm. And so this was a couple of different stories about the homework being found in a stolen car. And then finding out it was from a child who belonged to a Hollywood, you know, hero who was sick. And then they tied that in with this real life character who was known as the dude, who's, you know, so they've tied it all in together. And out of that, they came up with the story. They wanted to do that noir crime film, but talk about the early 90s in America and combine it all together. So it's a mishmash of ideas, but I love it.
Yeah.
It works. Yeah. Do you remember the, I guess, general opinion of this movie when it came out?
It was pretty underrated. And I to be honest with you, even though it's, you know, it's talked about in sacred, you know, tones for some people. Yeah. I still think it's a pretty underrated film, to be honest with you. I think it's an amazing achievement.
Yeah. Wasn't there the whole dudism thing?
Yeah, there's a whole there's a religion based off this.
I do find it so interesting that we're talking about this movie that has like a religion following and has all these, you know, interesting things to say about religion.
Yeah.
You know, it's very interesting that this is one of your favorite movies.
Yeah, it's funny. I think that's the appeal of a Coen brothers film, is that they, a lot of their films are about, you know, as two Jewish guys who are not practicing Jewish as in religious or anything, but very observant about different customs and stuff, and very knowledgeable. Shabbos. Yeah, very very knowledgeable about their history. They are commentating on culture all the time, even when they're not. You know, like, it doesn't seem like it's overtly commentating on culture. They do in this. And so having this guy who's a leftover from the 60s in the 90s, it sort of just speaks to, you know, something that people are missing, and that's why people like the dudism. You know, they want to be like the dude. You know, there's a lot there to draw yourself to, I guess.
Yeah.
That's interesting. From what I've read, there were mixed reviews, but even looking at Rotten Tomatoes, they've got it sitting at 83, which is really high. So I don't know if that just means that the people who didn't like it really didn't like it.
Yeah.
Or I don't know if Rotten Tomatoes has like a retroactive thing of people reviewing it now.
I think it's definitely a retroactive thing, yeah.
Probably.
Which makes it hard to judge what it was like at the time. But I've got a quote here from The Guardian that criticized the movie as a bunch of ideas shoveled into a bag and allowed to spill out at random. The film is infuriating and will win no prizes, but it does have some terrific jokes. Yeah. I find that, like, some of that is actually accurate, but the general sense as being coming from a negative perspective, I view all those things as positives.
Yes. Yeah, that's it. And I think it went over a lot of people's heads at the time. Mm. I think that people were expecting something very different from a Coen Brothers film. And to this day, it's a weird movie. It's a mishmash of, like, at first you think, is this going to be a Western film type of thing? They have a really Western motif to begin, and
tumbleweed, yeah.
Yeah, that keeps bubbling up. Then
it
there's
just goes
the,
on the... F- beach.
Yeah,
what?
down he goes in California, and then you've got this noir sense, and I love there's a couple of different, there's so many different theories about this film. One of my favorite ones is that every character in the movie, no matter how small they are, is in a different movie. So the stranger, the narrator, is in a Western.
Yeah.
You know, the dude is in a slacker comedy, you know, stoner type of film. You know, Walter is in a Nam, post-Nam, gritty war film, revenge movie. Yeah, you know, and everybody's got a different idea of where they are. And it really does have all these senses of different tones and feelings as it goes along.
Yeah. Well, that's where I feel like it's really kind of absurdist. Like, it's kind of just this thing of like, you know, by the end of the movie, you know, like, what's this grand tale about? It's about a guy who, oh my God, he made it into the semifinals of the bowling. He's like, yay! Oh, and also his friend died, I guess. Yeah. Whatever. You know.
So the movie was filmed for $15 million. It made 46 worldwide, but only 18 in the US. So it was considered a disappointment at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm thinking the VHS and DVD sales would more than make up for it. And that's why it is a cult classic. Before we move on to kind of the categories, I just want to do a little bit of a tangent on Philip Seymour Hoffman, because one of the great actors of our generations, and so good in a small role in this movie.
I mean, was it a small role? It felt like it was almost a bigger role than The Big Lebowski.
It feels like it, you know? But if you actually like look at how many lines he has and how much time he's on the screen, it's fairly small. Like,
But compared to
yeah, because like he introduces him to The Big Lebowski and then leaves the room, and you get like these long monologues from The Big Lebowski. But yeah, I just love the way he portrays this character and the personality. Like, you can't tell if he's really proud of his boss or if he's just like ultra professional in this like Waylon Smithers style character.
Total Waylon Smithers.
Loves his boss.
Yeah, and he's like uncomfortably nervous at everything that the dude has, but he's also trying to be super polite at the same time. He just nails that kind of like aesthetic. It's such a fun thing for an actor that you know can do pretty much anything, and he's a dramatic, you know, he's a dramatic superstar, and he's won Oscars and everything, but yeah, he's just coming in for this little part in this comedy. I just love that he's down for it.
He had just been in Boogie Nights the year before. He had, you know, he was in the same year he did The Big Lebowski. He did Happiness, Patch Adams, all these other, like, he was at this stage in his career, he was a recognized but hardworking actor, like character actor.
Yeah.
And he's so different in this role. This is a really different role for him, but he's perfect, pitch perfect as Brandt right from the very beginning
when he's showing the dude
The Big Lebowski wall. It's perfect. Yeah. Perfect. That's one of my favorite bits where, and it says so much about the dude as well, that he's showing him a thing and he keeps touching the shoe, you know, that shoe sort of plate on the plaque. And he says, you know, he keeps just gently saying, don't touch that. And he's sort of doing his hand. And as the dude leaves, he touches it. And Philip Seymour Hoffman pulls the greatest face, as in like it's hurting him as he's touching it. He's great in it. And the fact that straight away he gets that his name is the dude.
Right.
So when Big Lebowski is saying, Mr. Lebowski, Brand is interpreting, saying, come on, the dude. Come on, dude. Yeah. I love him in this scene.
His interactions with Tara Reid, Bonnie Lebowski, are great as well. Because she's very clearly not someone that has earned any kind of respect. But he has to treat her as like,
otherwise he has to pay 100.
Yeah. Exactly.
He basically refers to her in the exact same terminology as he does the first lady, like, lovely woman.
Yes.
And, like, she's saying these, like, abhorrent things, and he's like, lovely woman.
There's the other great thing about the Coen brothers, and this is a great example of this in this film, is that in 20 minutes, the first 20 minutes of the film, we get everything we need to know about the dude. I mean, we do get the voiceover from the stranger, and we know he's a man of our times, you know, something. We know he's a lazy man. But just in the way that they film him, in the little choices that he makes non-verbally, we get so much about his character. We know that he's shifty because he's got the milk in the very first scene that we see. Like, he opens the milk, he's paying it, paying it with a 69-cent check.
Yeah, I love that.
On the September 11th, 1991 is the date where it's all set. You know, and he's paying for it with a milk mustache on his thing. You know, we find out, you know, he's got, with that scene with Brandt, even from the very opening scene with the two morons smashing him into the toilet, he's got an attitude. You know, like,
he's super chill.
He's super chill, but like, they put him down in the toilet and they're like, where's the money? And he's like,
Well, let me check down
there. Yeah, it might be back down there. And so he's got an attitude about it. Yeah. I just love, in such a brief, short amount of time, we get to know this character in a way that they don't need to, like, let us know with all these big dialogues. Yeah, it's so Coen Brothers. It's great.
And just, like, from his outfit, you could look at it for 2 seconds in that first scene. He's wearing a dressing gown, flip-flops,
yes,
shorts, and the sunglasses inside. And you're like, okay, this guy's a chill bro.
Yeah, like he sits on the toilet, puts his glasses on. Yeah. It's just like,
yes,
that's him.
Yeah.
And that's our boy.
And the sunglasses, that's it. You saying that's perfect. The sunglasses are like, straight away, we know they're important because he reaches in the toilet, fishes them out of the toilet. It's like they protect him. They're like some sort of superpower thing. And the next time we see them is when
it ties his outfit together.
When he angers the big Lebowski by mentioning his wife, and he bangs the table, don't mention my wife, and he's getting authority blasted at him. He leans back, puts the sunglasses. It's like a shield to the world around him. I love that part of the character. Yeah. It's so cool.
Well, let's get into the categories by setting the scene with the number one song when this film released. Do you have any guesses?
Oh, 1998.
I didn't even look.
You'll feel foolish when I tell you.
No Scrubs by TLC.
That's a good guess because there's been a lot of TLC in this show, but no, it's not that.
I'm going to give up. Shaggy.
No. So I got, just for you, DJ, I've got Billboard and Aria.
Oh, yes, okay. Australia, represent.
So, you know, Billboard was My Heart Will Go On, Celine Dion.
Oh wow.
That's a tonal shift.
Yeah, I guess we're just after the release of Titanic.
Yes.
And then the movie released a few months later in Australia. We had Getting Jiggy With It by Will Smith.
Which was pretty close with Shaggy.
Yeah, that was my first album, Big Willie style. So shout out to Big Will.
Oh, yeah.
Thank God.
Which makes it great that they decided to set this film at the turn of the decade in either 90 or 90. I think you said 91.
Yeah, right? September 1991.
Because it feels like if you made a movie now, would you think to set it in 2010? Like,
yes.
I don't know if that would be like a choice that you would make, but for them, it was very much like it. A lot of things had changed between 90 and 98, and that was the world they wanted to set it in. I like that.
I mean, I remember hearing it was set during like the Gulf War, which is kind of you know, part of underpinning it. You know, like the whole noir thing is supposed to be like World War II. It's like big important stuff. Mm. Whereas, you know, this is set during like a meaningless kind of military crap thing. It's like
The aggression will not stand.
The aggression will not stand, and I love that. That's one of my favorite lines there, and it introduces pretty quickly that there's a thing in this film where the dude will hear something and repeat it.
He's constantly repeating things that other people have said.
Yeah, and other people do as well through it. But that's the first one that we get. This aggression will not stand from Bush on the TV, Bush Senior on the TV.
Yeah.
And then when he's talking to the Big Lebowski, he's like, listen, man, this aggression will not stand, you know. And from then we get like these common, these words keep popping up. Like we have the Chinaman phrase keeps coming up in that theme. We have Walter with a world of pain, Walter with am I wrong, you know, as a bit of a catchphrase.
And just constantly referring to Vietnam.
Yeah, the whole Vietnam thing.
Oh, yeah.
We have Brandt telling the dude, her life is in your hands, dude. And then the dude keeps repeating that around the place. Her life is in her hands, man. You know, the whole, even the fact that they're gonna cut off your Johnson, that the Johnson thing keeps coming up again and again and again as it goes on there.
It's a great touch.
Yeah, it's great. Or there's so many little bits like that where it's repeated through. Mm. It's beautiful.
Okay, so what have you done for me lately? Steve Buscemi has just done a series called Miracle Workers where he's playing God. Boardwalk Empire, he's of course had a big part in that series. Mm. Horace and Pete, Voldemort's vehicle. I say Voldemort, it was actually Louis C.K. But, you know, they're on par. You're not meant to talk about Louis anymore.
I'll talk about Louis all day long.
You know.
But that was a really great show. He played like a bipolar older brother to Louis C.K.'s character. Mm. They owned a bar together. And I don't know if many people saw that because it got released exclusively online, not on a streaming service.
Just on Louis' website.
Yeah. Mm. Steve Buscemi, he's worked constantly, consistently since before this film. And
yes.
Still, probably a staple of a character actor that can fill any role pretty much.
Yeah, can do anything.
Yeah. Like in Armageddon, he's playing a ladies man.
Yeah.
And I watched that like last year or earlier this year and I was like, they cast Steve Buscemi as a ladies man?
Yeah.
don't forget, he was, for about 30 seconds, he was Buddy Holly in Pulp Fiction with Quentin Tarantino when they went to the restaurant where all the American icons are. Okay. He's Buddy Holly for about 30 seconds in there and he looks exactly like Buddy Holly.
Perfect. John Goodman, similar. Like pretty much every main cast person in this movie has just worked consistently. They did a great job casting it.
He was in the 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Yes.
Yeah, yep. Kong, Skull Island, Once Upon a Time in Venice. Jeff Bridges has continued to make awesome movies, a lot of them with Coen Brothers. I love True Grit. He's awesome in that. And it shows, like, along with this movie, that even when they make something serious, they can inject a lot of humor into it because I think that movie's got a lot of great moments. He was in the Kingsman sequel pretty recently as well.
Yeah.
And the Tron remake.
And the Tron original as well. Don't forget that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's Jeff Bridges. He's one of my favorite actors of all time. Mm. Go back and look at his early stuff. One of the first films that he ever did was Starman. If you've never seen Starman, which is a great science fiction film where he's playing an alien. I'm not spoiling anything. He's playing an alien alien intelligence that is cloned itself on a dead husband.
Mm.
And it is an amazing film so early on. And it's
85, I think.
Yeah, 85, 84, somewhere around there. And Jeff Bridges is just phenomenal in it.
Okay. John Turturro.
Yep.
He's probably mostly known for being in the Transformers movies, I want to say, from the past couple decades.
Yep.
But I don't really recognize him from. He's just got one of those faces that he pops up.
Yeah. He's another character actor and, of course, is fantastic as the Jesus.
which I'm sure we will get to.
Oh, my.
I think this was Tara Reid's first movie, and she doesn't have much to do, but she's definitely a known and presence. And it was just before American Pie, which was probably her breakout as far as her demographic being that teen movie kind of thing. She's been doing Sharknado movies for the better part of a decade. And Peter Stormare, who is one of the nihilists, he's got another one of those guys that you always recognize.
Yeah.
He always plays a Russian or something.
Yes. Yeah.
And he was in Until Dawn. I don't know if you played that, but he was like the psychiatrist that would pop up interstitially.
Okay. Yeah.
Did like facial capture.
Yeah.
So that's what these guys have been up to.
Wait a minute, you're forgetting one of the major characters. One of the major characters, I would say the fourth most important character in this film, Julianne Moore, Maud Lebowski.
I was wondering when you were going to get to that.
Yeah, okay.
Jeff Bridges and Julianne Moore are both in one of those young adults fantasy kind of thingies.
She was in Kingsman as well.
Oh, yeah.
Just recently. She's been in everything. I mean, Julianne Moore is Julianne Moore, for crying out loud.
Yeah, she's a champ.
Yeah.
Okay, that's an omission. I'll wear that one.
Yeah, good work.
What is the... I mean, I got Tara Reid in there. So
yeah, well...
What's the most 90s moment of this film?
That was tough. Like, because I feel like a lot of... It's almost the reverse. Like, a lot of this movie just, like, dictated the 90s of just like, whoa. Mm. I don't know.
It's
bowling?
It's a bit timeless.
Yeah, very timeless. Like, it could have been a 70s or a... modern movie.
Exactly. I think, but it is firmly set right at the beginning during the first Gulf War. So that, I think, is the most, I mean, it's set, it has a date on it right from the beginning. We see the speech.
Is that cheating, though, if you're just like, well, it actually, if you look at the calendar, it says 1991.
There's a bit of commentary about that through it. And at the time, it was a bit stronger than what it carries now 20 years later. But remember, one of the discussions that's going on is about Saddam Hussein. We have, in one moment, Walter, who's correcting the dude for using the phrase Chinaman, is then talking about the towel heads, talking about the camel effers, talking about, you know, different phrases about the people that they're fighting. So there's this funny commentary on what even back then was politically correct,
but
also setting that in about, you know, about a war that is different to Nam, because he's called, you know, very much that's one of the last conversations you hear them having, how the war is completely useless compared to his war. And so there's a commentary about that, you know, 90s, you know, part of it. But again, it's set in 91, made in 98. So it's a weird, you know, sort of weird thing like that.
Yeah, there's a few things that happen that are very 90s. So you have like Saddam Hussein himself showing up in a fantasy dream sequence.
Was that Saddam? Is that someone from the Gulf War? I don't know.
No, it's about
so he was in the Gulf War.
Yeah, he's in the first one. Yeah.
And that's like,
I don't know history. I'm just like video game movies.
Was it Hot Shots 2 that had a big Saddam plot?
Yeah, and it's probably the same lookalike actor.
Yeah,
probably.
That just the fact that they're like smoking in the bowling alley inside is very 90s. Mm. You wouldn't see that today. I love the scenes where he's lying there listening to his Walkman, and he's also got a beeper on him. Yeah. Like that combination is something that wouldn't have been seen since the decade.
The great big phone that he has to carry, the portable phone.
Yeah. Not even a cell phone, just a portable phone. Yeah, like, that is a monstrosity of a machine.
Yeah. It just looks like he's got a handbag, but it's a solid plastic handbag.
Yeah.
Like, what?
That's the kind of phone that you would show kids and they just wouldn't know what it was.
The first time I saw it, they were in the car and was just like, is that just a car phone or something? It was like, no. Mm. It's a regular phone, but it has a receiver and everything, and it's portable.
Yeah. So the cast itself, do you feel like, because they've had consistently, you know, solid work and they're still working now, does it feel like a 90s cast having John Goodman, Jeff Bridges and Steve Buscemi in those key roles?
They nailed it with that, even though I think two of them weren't their first choices. I think Donnie was always going to be Steve Buscemi. I think the other two were sort of second choices or third choices, but they've knocked it out of the park. They just happened to get three great, if I include Julianne Moore, four of the best actors in the last 30 years.
Oh, and Philip Seymour Hoffman.
And Philip Seymour Hoffman. Yeah, there's a whole string of fantastic people who are in this.
Yeah.
So I think they knocked it out of the park there.
Yeah. We'll move on to most iconic scene. This is a tough one because
there's a lot
of like great scenes, but like, the lasting imagery for me is just the bowling alley itself. And there's so many like different scenes in the bowling alley. But I feel like the second one is the one with the Hotel California playing Spanish version.
Yeah.
You got the Jesus. That's the scene that gives you the classic line, well, you know, that's just your opinion, man. And Donnie like chipping in with I'm the walrus when they're talking about Lennon. Not John Lennon.
I'm the walrus, dude. I'm the walrus. Well, you know, like keep on popping up in the back. Yeah. It's perfect. That is a great scene.
That is the scene to me that's like, I guess it's like all the bowling scenes are kind of the iconography of this film, but that's the one bowling scene that stands out the most to me.
I mean, I thought that was a pretty good one. The one that kind of jumped to my mind though more was the whole crazy like drugged
up
dream sequence kind of thing.
Which one? Because there's a
The second one, the like way the longer one where it's basically a whole James Bond show tune thing, and he's sliding through like all the women, and then starts looking up and's like, oh my god, he's like upskirting them, and then, it's just like, whoa, I wasn't thinking of that.
To one of my favorite Kenny Rogers, early Kenny Rogers song. That's actually Kenny Rogers sitting there with his original band. It's a phenomenal song.
That's awesome.
And that's a really dividing. For critics at the time and even for people today, the dream sequences or the nightmare sequences, the drug inducement sequences the knockout trips that he's having, they're the most divisive thing about these films. Like people either love them or they're like, this makes it really embarrassing. They really, really hate them.
I'm on the fence with them because they're so unique and quirky, but they just go a bit long for me.
It is
and
a long scene.
It's just like, by the time that one comes around, we've already had the one where he's flying through the sky with the bowling ball, and it's getting a little bit worn by then for me. But
I still love it. I hear you. It is a long scene, and it's a bit weird. The pacing of it is weird, but the expressions we get on Jeff Bridges on the dude's face, I can't not have the movie for those expressions and the dance moves. Jeff Bridges dancing down the steps is one of the greatest things.
Oh yeah. That is great.
I guess for me, my favorite scenes is probably, I'm going to cheat here, and have the stranger, the narrator. So we have the narrator at the beginning. We don't see him exactly at the halfway point, halfway point in the movie. The movie's 2 hours long. The stranger appears again at the point where the dude is at his absolute lowest, and the stranger appears at the end. And the narrator, in what he says, is obviously, and if you know a Coen Brothers film, they love commentating on like a godlike perspective on humanity type of thing.
Right. I mean, and Sam Elliott is pretty much a god.
He's the so great. That voice is the voice of God for sure. Mm-hmm. And his you know, observing and he's wrapping up at the end is great. And again, we get the repeated thing because at the middle of the scene, in the middle scene with the stranger and the dude talking, as just the thing's about to turn around, the stranger says to him, you know, sometimes, you beat the bar and the bar bites you type of thing. You bite the bar, bites. And then the dude repeats it back to him at the end.
I had a question about that because when I was watching it, like on Amazon on my phone. Oh my God, how much the times have changed, et cetera, et cetera. And I was doing it with subtitles and they subtitled it as the bear.
The last scene?
For like the whole thing.
Okay. In the script, this is how nerdy I am. Okay. Oh sorry. God, in the original script.
I shouldn't have asked.
I know. I'm sorry. The stranger says the bar in the middle scene. And the dude repeats the bear, getting it wrong at the end. So that's in the original script. Maybe it's different in the, the subtitle.
Having a bar bite you.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Well,
yeah, I'm not familiar with that expression.
It might be, again, it's an old Western thing. But anything to do with a stranger and that breaking the fourth wall of commentating on the fact that this is a movie, this is a story, this is like a perspective of God or an angel or an observer, whatever you want to call it, from an outside outside of humanity's, observance, it takes it all up a level into, okay, what type of parable is this? What type of story are we supposed to be learning? Mm-hmm. And, and the final line, I was sad about when Donnie passed away, but I happen to know there's a little Lebowski on the way. And so for all the hardcore Lebowski fans, they're like, are we going to get a sequel? Are we going to get a sequel with the son of Lebowski?
Yeah.
Anyway.
I wonder how much that plays into the amount of speculation that goes into what this movie's about.
Big time.
There's so much, and I don't know where else it might come up in this conversation, so we might as well talk about it now, but the whole nihilism thing and the fact that
this is the intellectual comedy.
Yeah, the dude is essentially a nihilist as well, and there's these theories.
He's a pacifist.
He's also so nonchalant that he almost slots into that philosophy as well. Things have meaning. That there's all these discussions about nihilism as a theme of the whole movie, not just that there's this group of nihilists.
Yes,
but then it's like pacifism. Like you've got different characters representing capitalism and all these isms.
Yes, and the Jewish faith itself.
Yeah.
In the man who is converted with Walter and how passionate he is about it. I think the dude is a little bit more, because he actually the difference that they're saying in the film is
he's more Buddhist.
Yeah, he's a bit more zen about everything. Yeah, he's hard to pin down because he cares about some stuff. He doesn't care about other things. Mm. Politically, he's hard to pin down because, he's part of the original, what does he say? I was part of the original team that wrote the paper in university and I was part of this original team. But then he has a Nixon poster in his wall, Nixon bowling, right? And Nixon, who's a Republican in the state. So it's this, what does he actually believe in? Mm. We don't really know. And I don't think
doesn't matter.
It doesn't really, it doesn't really matter.
Because absurdism.
But absurdism, yes, but he does care about things, whereas the nihilist make a point.
I meant more the story in general, but yeah.
Yeah, the Coens certainly don't care as much as everyone that talks about it. That's what I've learned.
For sure. And where the nihilists keep on saying, we don't care about anything, nothing, they keep on talking about that. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. In the end, I don't know. Yeah, I don't think it matters.
Yeah. No. I don't think he's nihilist because he's getting stressed out about stuff. And if it was really a nihilist, then who cares?
True. This is just things that I've read.
So yeah.
It's not my opinion. Man.
Okay. Well, form your own opinion.
What holds up the best?
Oh. It all holds up the best. I can't think of any scene that doesn't hold up. I mean, little choices.
Maybe the Jesus parts.
You're not a fan of the Jesus parts.
Well, I mean, it depends specifically on what scale we're talking about. If we're talking about it from, would anyone be offended? Would this be made? Even though there's probably a question later on about that. But in that sense, I imagine that's an issue. But in terms of do I like it? I mean, well, okay, maybe I won't say I like the Jesus parts. Maybe I won't say I like watching a grown man lick a bowling ball and then, polishing his ball and he's squatting so, the ball is just an 8-year-old head level. I can't say I like that.
No, I didn't make that connection either.
Well, I mean, he's squatting and everything, yeah. You know. It's like you can't just stand up and, you know. Anyway.
It is over the top. It is totally.
But I do like it.
It's totally the choice of the actor. The Coen brothers were blown away that he pulled out everything. The costume, the fingernails, everything was brought in by the actor. It's one of, John T's favourite characters he's ever played, to the point with where he's made a sequel film with the Coens' blessings, but they're not involved at all. Yeah. And the Jesus film is about to come out,
next year,
they're saying.
Yeah, right. Maybe we might have to do a sequel episode.
Yeah, it's not the kind of character, small side character that you would think would get its own movie, but here we are.
Especially in this day and age.
He's in the film for like a total of about 5 minutes,
even less, I would say. Yeah. I mean, half of that is a musical sequence.
Yes, him slow motion.
Yeah. But he just leaves it all out there. And, you know, I guess there's a bit of depth to him as having this, you know, mysteriously weird and criminal background. And I think, you know, we know that's going to be a plot point of this sequel.
It's just
his redemption.
It's just it is part of the comedy, but it's just like, it's very hard to not see that as a possible thing when he's like licking bowling balls and stuff. It's like,
He's a weird guy.
He just gets his bowling ball and he's just like, putting his fingers in the holes.
Is he trying to psych out? Is he trying to like? I think it's like, you know.
He's trying to intimidate the competition with his sexual energy.
Maybe, but I think it might be a thing where it's like, you know, some musicians feel like, you know, they get their guitar like Prince, you know, and it's a very like sexual thing for him to perform and to play, and it's like, you know. You hear like Arnold Schwarzenegger talk about like pumping iron, and it's like he compares it to sex. And this guy who's
Down with that. I don't think bowling is very analogous to sex.
This is a good time to talk about bowling, because it's for this guy, like, he's clearly obsessed with bowling.
Yes.
And bowling, for people who bowl, it's an obsession. Like, it's their art form, it's their music, it's their weightlifting. I went bowling last week and
I
And the people who go bowling like every week for fun, I always feel like they are what people think the stereotype of us gaming nerds are.
But I'm not usually jerking it while I play games.
Well, neither of
them. And also, I'm usually not playing games in that public of a setting.
No. But I mean, it's an interesting group of people.
Security cameras.
But they've found their community, you know, they're there, they're having a great time. They've invested a lot of time to become good at bowling, which I suck at bowling. Like, I bowl like a 70 or an 80, you know, because you only do it like every 4 years. Or
yeah.
But bowling. How key do you think it is to adding flavor to this movie?
I think it is, because even back then in the 90s, in 1998, bowling was considered, I think, pretty much the same as it is now, like this weird, hokey pastime for weirdos, type of thing. It's considered very uncool. And the fact that these guys consider it their like national pastime and something that they, when everything else fails, it's like, let's go bowling. Yeah. They're always bowling. And there's something beautiful about it. And it's definitely in the bowling alley where it's set in, which is gone now. It's been, I think it's a school or a car park or something now in LA, but where it was, that was a really iconic, you know, that 50s Las Vegas-y type of vibe. So it sort of echoes in to the whole feeling of it coming back. And I want to mention, since you brought up the bowling alley, and I'm going to tie it back to the Stranger again, because he's my favorite character in it.
Yeah.
If you saw the seasons of Fargo that were not done by the Coen brothers, but the Coen brothers sanctioned them, you would have seen in the, I'm thinking it's the second season or the third season, they bring back the concept of the bowling alley being a portal to God or heaven.
Which season is this? Okay, is this the one with Ewan McGregor, or is it?
It's the one with, it's the Ewan McGregor one, because it's got an actress that I really, really like, Mary Elizabeth Winstead.
Oh,
and remember, they're being chased by the killers in the snow. They come across a bowling alley. They go in, and it's
saved.
And it's but it's a completely different universe there, and they're told about a child. They're told about this weird supernatural stuff, and then the bowling alley doesn't exist.
I need to finish season three.
Wow, spoilers there.
But I think that's a way that are most. I mean, because it's made by Coen Brothers fanatics, right? And they're speaking the language of the Coen Brothers films, and this speaks to this bowling alley and the stranger character being, you know, almost like a portal to another universe, another dimension.
Yeah.
And I love that aspect.
And,
of-
and then just on the 10th lane, you've got like Sisyphus trying to push a bowling ball up the lane. It's like, oh yeah, it all makes sense.
So as far as what holds up the best, that was a great tangent, but what holds up the best, I think the soundtrack is still amazing because it wasn't contemporary music. It was all like these great songs from previous decades.
And in the film nerd parlance, it's all diegetic music.
What does that mean?
Diegetic music means it's not a soundtrack on top of a scene.
But it's all part of the...
It's all part of the scene. So every scene, the soundtrack is either coming out of the dude's cassette tape. It's coming out of a radio.
Mm-hmm.
Even the opening, Tumbling Tumbleweed song, which is over the soundtrack, as it moves into the bowling alley, it reduces down and it's being played on a radio. You hear the same song on the radio. So they'll do that quite a bit where, like, for example, the Jesus scene where the Gypsy Kings are doing Hotel California, a nod to the Eagles through the film. That soundtrack is filling up your speakers and your ears, but as it goes into normal motion, out of this slow motion dream sort of sequence, it's being played on the speakers over the thing. So all diegetic in a sense, and it's I love
that's it. That's a cool touch. Although, what about the dream sequence? That has to be an exception. Unless he's listening.
It's a diegetic because that's the sound. We're listening to his brain.
Okay. That's great.
Yeah, that should be more like heartbeat sounds, little synapses and everything.
Yeah. I think the characters hold up really well. Like, they could all appear in a movie now and still be just as entertaining. Walter's wokeness with the Chinaman is interesting. As you know, it's not the preferred nomenclature.
Yes,
Asian American, please. But I guess I didn't realize. I must have slept over the other references.
Well, literally, as they walk out into the car after this, so after that, he pulls out of the gun.
Yeah.
And then they're walking out into that, he then starts talking about the war and talking about, you know, using exactly derogatory words for Arabs. Mm. So it's sort of pointing out that it points out, I mean, I think all of that points out that Walter is trying to be a grown-up, but he's in arrested development 100%. He's a child, basically.
He's trying to be a grown-up, but this is after he's left the bowling alley in which he's pulled a gun on someone because he thought he did a foul.
Exactly.
That's a good segue into what holds up the worst. And TJ might have trouble with this one because he just said that everything holds up the best. But I guess it would be, I mean,
Jesus,
the pulling a gun out in the bowling alley. I wonder if that would fly these days. And I know the cops do turn up and they somehow escape without it. But that's
just like ignoring them.
That's like pretty glaring. And I'm not saying it's a bad choice for the movie, but it is a glaring moment of like, is this happening? Like, it feels like today, like, a surreal kind of this would never really happen type of thing.
Yeah.
Or someone would fire back at him or someone would, you know, try to take him out.
Tackle him.
Exactly.
It could have been a very short movie.
Everyone's just like, oh, there's like Walter pulling out his gun again.
He might have done that before. He might have been known for doing that.
Yeah.
I find it hard to answer this one. What holds up the worst? I think they could have, me personally, some of the things that I really like about the film and the things that make it hold up and rewatchable are some of the theories about it. Like, is Donnie real? Like, that's one of my favorite theories.
Yeah,
there.
I have heard this.
Aww.
Yeah,
is Donnie exactly? Is does
that's so unfair? Like, he already gets such a crappy run of it, and then he just like dies like in the background of a scene that nobody cares about. Yeah. And now this series that he didn't even exist.
Because nobody interacts with Donnie. He lives in his own universe.
Apart from Walter. Yeah.
Except for, is he a figment of Walter's imagination? Is he, you know, is he a dead buddy of Walter's from Vietnam that's a ghost, you know, type of thing?
What, from Apocalypse Now?
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's been debunked.
Jeez. Oh, totally debunked. Yeah. It's totally debunked. Everyone has debunked it. But these are the things that you can rewatch in the film and make it fun.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, the actual plot and the mechanics of the plot of the movie are totally rewatchable, and that's where I might even tweak it a little bit if I had to tweak it. Is I think Maud's character is fascinating. Maud Lebowski is absolutely fascinating. Yeah. I personally am on the theory that she's the one who's masterminding the entire scam. Mm. You know, making sure that the money goes out to her dad, make sure it goes out to the nihilist that she's employed. You know, et cetera, yeah. et cetera, et cetera. And I think that would be fun if they could beef that up a little bit. But maybe if you beefed it up, it would show the hand too much that she's in control.
Yeah, I don't know. It's tough because you say about beefing it up, but I actually feel like the movie's a little bit too long.
I wouldn't disagree with that.
It, I felt like it's about 20 minutes too long. And kind of the third act, after they smash up the car in a hilarious scene, he goes and meets the Treehorn, the pornographer.
Yes.
Then he sleeps with Maud, and then he meets the private eye.
Yep.
I feel like that kind of 15, 20 minutes is just added like twists and turns to the plot that don't actually add a whole lot. Like they're enjoyable because the whole movie's enjoyable. Yeah, because
the whole movie is this whole crazy twist and turn, like ridiculous kind of thing.
But even after that car smashing scene, I feel like they could have skipped to where the dude's driving his car and he figures out that, you know, he's been scammed by the Big Lebowski, and they go back there and see like Bunny's car crash. Like I feel like that jump could, it makes it a bit more digestible as a film. But
you young people wanting the film snappier.
I'm blaspheming here. No, it's that was just me because like you know you're watching a movie and you get to a point and you kind of hit pause to see how long there is to go. And it's like
no.
Oh,
yeah, I can't. I love it all. I love it all. You know, because if we don't get the private eye scene, we don't get the Brother Seamus. I'm a Brother Seamus. Oh, what, you're an Irish monk. Right. That is a fantastic, beautiful, you know, beautiful line in it. But I'd love it all, so I'm biased.
Fair.
Yeah.
Do you think that you must think that there's a limit to how long a movie should go?
It's just under 2 hours.
Yeah.
Feels good to me. I'm not bored through it.
Sammy, you mentioned Jesus, but then you also kind of said that you liked it, so I don't know.
I mean, once again, like, and this, if it's the next question, that'd be great. You know, good segue to, like, things people will not accept if we remade this movie. Like that's, like, a little bit tasteless to some people, especially, you know, Pell and all that kind of jazz.
So your whole problem with the Jesus character is that he's presented as a pedophile in this film.
I mean, it's one of those things where, like, I do find it, like, a little bit tasteless. It is kind of one of those things I do kind of, you know, awkwardly laugh of, like, oh, God, that's, like, the most aggressive ball polishing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
But, you know, it feels a little bit dated.
Okay.
You know, if I had to pick one thing that probably is what it would be.
Sure. I think that it's okay to have bad people in films.
Oh, no. Like, I totally agree with that. It's just, like, it's a bit of a... I don't know. Like, I don't want to be offended on people's behalf or be that kind of a millennial kind of thing. But, yeah, it's... I don't know.
I mean, I asked the question, what holds up the worst? So, that's fine. I think that's fine to say that holds up the worst. It doesn't mean that you would change it necessarily. But the only other thing that I'll add is... the character of Bunny feels kind of glossed over. Her. Like, that is someone who I feel like could have had a bit more depth. We get this idea that she's a shallow, literally, like, prostituting gold digger porn star, but you don't get any sense of why the Big Lebowski cares for her enough to go through this, if that's what we're supposed to be thinking at that point in the film. Mm. And I don't know if that was just... I'm sure it was just a decision they made based on the script they had, but I feel like... today, there might be a bit more added to her role.
Yeah, I can say that.
Yeah. Again, I'm bad here because I just think the movie's
perfect.
You just
think it's perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Okay, so who would be the most offended if this came out now?
I mean, like, Christians, maybe?
No, I'm a full-blown Christian and I love this film. I loved it all the way.
Chinaman?
look, I think people... I honestly don't think I would know any...
Germans?
I don't think any Germans or actually Asian people would, or Chinese people would be actually offended by the characters in the film.
No, well, actually, nihilists wouldn't be offended by anything.
They're not supposed to care of anything. I think you'd get the offended brigade, people who want to find offense in things, would be like, okay, you shouldn't use those words in a film, even if it's in jest, you shouldn't do that. But that's sort of the point, that these characters... are outdated. They're living in the past. Yep. And even the one, Walter, who's trying to bring the dude into the present, even Walter's imperfect and jumps straight back in there as well. Yep. So
I don't know. I feel like Peter might have a problem with the ferret in the bathtub. Just because it doesn't take much to get them offside.
Pedophilia victims?
Yeah, but again, this is the whole, and again, we'll see what happens with the sequel.
We will find someone.
Well, with the sequel of this Jesus film coming out, I think a big part of it, and the film never says, we're relying on Walter, who's lying constantly throughout the film, telling a story about how this person is a pedophile because he's such a sexualized character. So I'll flip it and say that Walter was slut-shaming Jesus because Jesus is such an overt, mouthy, sexual creature that Walter's being a prude and saying, you know, we don't like this because he keeps on talking all this sexual stuff and hence getting a reputation like that. I personally think that's what the sequel's going to be about. It's going to be about a redemption of this guy who's been victimized in this way. I could be talking in my butt. I have no idea.
He's offended because he knows that guns, and he has a lot of respect for guns, and he doesn't want them to be shoved up people's as possibly like a kink thing.
Yeah.
Oh dear.
So does The Big Lebowski pass the internet relevancy test?
Well, no.
Oh,
you serious?
I haven't seen any GIFs or anything.
Are you kidding me?
Are you serious?
I personally, in my circle, I've never seen anything outside of like me specifically looking for it.
Okay.
That might be part of your age.
I will say this. If you type opinion into the GIF generator, the first thing that comes up is, that's just your opinion.
Okay. Man.
And that's like the go-to, like, let's like end this argument right here. Yeah. I don't want to talk to you anymore.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll even put this. If you type in, as a Christian, if I type in Jesus into a GIF generator, the first couple might be Jesus and a crucifix, and then the next one is Jesus from The Big Lebowski.
Oh, polishing his bowl.
Exactly. So, and I'm still not offended, but
it's actually human.
Why do you need that much force to polish them? You can just
He's psyching out everybody else.
It's aggression. It's a visual gag. Come on.
Yeah.
And like The Dude Abides, that's another one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I think it's incredibly relevant today still, the film, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's relevant. I just don't think many people use it. At least not my age.
Yeah. Well, how do we think smartphones and social media would change a movie like this coming out now? Because we've said how timeless it is.
You wouldn't have the giant thing strapped to you.
That's true. He would just have a cell phone.
Yeah.
Mobile phone.
And one of the important plot points in the film is the dude's answering machine, which is a problem in a lot of films from the 80s and 90s and even to early 2000s. The answering machine is still a thing.
Yeah, I love the kind of plot point, or not plot point, but the device of people leaving messages and you can't stop it from happening.
Yeah.
He's getting interviewed by the cops and it's just like, oh, well, there's your car showing up.
Yeah, yeah. Look, but one of the points might be that as they're researching information, if they had Facebook, that might change things. Yeah. You know,
I was thinking about that, but I kind of feel the exact opposite because I feel like when you go onto Facebook, then you Google like, you know, Jeffrey Lebowski, and you're like, oh, you know, there's a Jeff Lebowski in this area. You know, somehow from that you find out his details. Then you end up in the exact same situation.
Yeah.
Because there's probably like a whole bunch of other Sam Harkins.
Exactly. So you could, you could make that even part of the plot point of the mixed up identity because... Yeah.
That's how we modernize this. Perfect.
in the reboot that's coming.
Yeah.
I think if it was happening now, like, I know it's complicated. Did they fake the kidnapping or is it just a misunderstanding?
They have CSI on it.
I think you would definitely know these days if it was legit or not because of like how present people are on social media.
Yes.
Someone like Bunny would definitely be posting Instagram selfies
100%.
With her friends in Palm Springs or
But that
whatever.
Could be, instead of a toe being sent, it could be her Instagram account. You know, look, she's put an Instagram, like the kidnappers have put a photo up on her Instagram.
Oh my God, hi, hashtag kidnapped.
Exactly, all that type of stuff. So, yeah, I think so. I think it does.
Yeah. And I feel like a character like the dude, I don't even know if he would be on social media.
No.
Or if he would carry a mobile phone.
Yeah, and that's I think that's a big part of where it doesn't pass the internet relevancy test is that these characters, the dude and Walter especially, are dinosaurs, even a dinosaur in 1998. The dude is a leftover remnant from the 60s. Walter is a leftover remnant of Nam. Mm. And, you know, Donnie is just an enigma of Donnie.
Donnie doesn't even exist.
the naive innocent there. And the one who is the most modern, the most current person is Maud Lebowski. Mm, she is incredibly coming. She's a strong feminist. Mm. You know, she's confronting. She's connected with all this new stuff. And she's totally eclipsed and smarter than all the men in the room put together. So, I don't know. I'm sort of two-sided about that part.
Yeah.
So could you make this in 2019? And what would the 2019 version be?
Oh.
And it's a tough question because it's a movie that was set 7 years previous to it coming out.
It totally could be remade because there's all kinds of, like, you know, like quirky kind of comedies, you know, that aren't specifically... You know, like as wacky, you know, like the stuff like Little Miss Sunshine, you know, was the thing that came to mind of like, you know, a somewhat modern kind of, you know, character comedy kind of thing.
Yeah, I think the from the plot perspective, the whole like mistaken identity, huge miss, like it's like Pineapple Express is a movie that goes in a similar path where it's like two stoners who get caught up in a drug crime, like, gangs and all that kind of thing.
Because like a lot of this was, you know, taken, lifted directly and taken from like noir novels and movies back in the day. So, you know, and back in the 1998, the Coen brothers are referencing films from like the 30s and 40s to make that. So, I think there's a smart way of updating it and keeping it pretty timeless. But the fun thing that I did as a thinking about if we made a 2019 or a 2020 version, who would you cast in these roles?
Yeah. And?
I came up with a few, all right? I've got to confess. Okay. Right. I did come up with a few. Because, okay, this is how nerdy I am about this film. Jeff Bridges was 49 going on 50 when he made that. And he was already, and as we've already noted, he'd already had a career for 20 years as a leading handsome man, so you know? 50. So you've got to think about someone. Yeah, exactly. Who's at that same
Tom
bracket?
Hanks.
No. He's way, no way. Could the, dude, the dude couldn't be Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
Hanks.
I would Tom love Hanks. To see Tom Hanks playing a stoner. That
no.
I can't see it.
Walter, played by John Goodman. John Goodman was about 45 at the time. So he had just come off, in the same year that The Big Lebowski came out, the atrocity that is Blues Brothers 2000 came out.
That was not good.
He'd also just done The Flintstones. And he was also just finished Roseanne, right? The first initial 6-7 seasons of Roseanne had just finished. Donnie, as Steve Buscemi, he's timeless. He was 40 when this was made. And then you've got Julianne Moore, who was this amazing, upcoming actress. And she was about 36, 37 at the time. So I'm thinking, I went out there and looked at actors who are in those age groups.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, so I present, I'm going to let you guys vote.
Okay. But
this is who I thought. Could play some people,
this is
right?
A surprise.
Paul Rudd as the dude.
Yeah, I feel like he looks too young. I know he's probably the same age.
He's the same age.
He hasn't aged in like 15 years.
All right, here's a real obvious answer.
Yeah,
Luke Wilson.
Yes,
Luke Wilson as the dude.
Yeah, I could see that.
Right, or I'll give you another one. Same age now, almost the same career. Matthew McConaughey.
I could say that.
Yeah.
I could say that.
Either of those guys, if they can stack on a few kgs and grow.
Let themselves go a little bit.
Yeah, just give them a bodysuit, whatever.
Okay, a really obvious...
Well, people are talking about when, you know, we had Thor, like, wasn't it, we're getting references to the Lebowski in there. Mm.
That definitely, and that shows you how current Lebowski is, how culturally relevant is. Look, my personal pick that I would have... And it's a little bit left of center, would be someone, and a lot of people don't even know who he is, but Justin Theroux, Jennifer Aniston's husband.
Yeah,
he was in The Leftovers. He's been in a lot of films.
He's the one who's the president of Canada.
Yeah, he's a really interesting actor. He's a bit of a leading heartthrob guy. I think he would be able to play, and he's got a bit of a Jeff Bridges type of vibe, and he's a really versatile actor. Okay. I'd love to see what he would did in something like this.
Yeah.
But if you want to get a 2020... culturally appropriate dude,
okay,
blow your mind.
Yeah,
Dave Chappelle. Dave Chappelle is the dude.
I don't know. I don't know. I don't. I can't see that working.
You can't see Dave Chappelle as a stoner dude.
I can, but I mean...
Maybe not as a lazy stoner dude.
Oh, totally. And especially, here's where I'm going to get meta.
He got really buff lately, though.
He's gotten really buff. I mean, let him go for a little bit. But let's go even meta. As we're recording this, Dave Chappelle is all across the news because his new special is politically incorrect. Mm-hmm. The offended brigade have come out in droves and said, Dave Chappelle, we're not happy with you anymore. Out you go. You're using wrong language. You're talking about, trans people in a wrong way, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. Being meta with that and the cultural inappropriateness that goes on in the film, I think Dave Chappelle's a great pick.
It kind of makes sense from the perspective of if you're going to reboot something, you have to do it from a different cultural perspective. And that's the whole like, oh, let's make Ghostbusters with women or let's make a black version of the Big Lebowski.
Well, I wouldn't want to do that. I don't like, just transferring it over there or women or anything like that. But I think throwing in someone like Dave Chappelle and that, there's a sort of a vibe there. Exactly. Then you've got to think.
Martin Lawrence.
Yeah. Do we get The Rock to play Walter or something like that? All right. Here's my version of Walter. Right?
Okay. Yeah.
Most obvious one, Nick Offerman.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking about it. The other one that I was thinking, it's probably not the right age group, but just in terms of the intensity, like, what if you got Adam Sandler? How crazy would that be?
That would be interesting. I think two other guys that could be put out there, but it might be a bit too comedy, would be Jack Black. You can imagine Jack Black blowing up.
He was in Tropic Thunder and everything, and I could say that.
Yeah. Yeah. Or my personal pick, because I just love him, but it might be too comedy, Zach Galifianakis. Well, I've said that wrong. Zach Galifianakis.
Galifianakis.
Yeah.
Galifianakis. So there we go. We'll get it right eventually.
Could he be the dude?
I thought of him as the dude, but I think of him being a post-war pent-up angry guy.
I think those three
really good picks.
I got one more for you. David Harbour, who is Hopper from Stranger Things.
Yeah, I could see that.
I reckon you could totally do it.
I think, Who was the first guy you said?
Nick Offerman.
I think he's my pick.
Yeah, Nick Offerman.
But they're all really
Nick
good.
Nick or Adam.
All right, lastly, really quick. Donnie, right? The Steve Buscemi role.
Poor boy.
Bill Hader.
He's sufficiently weird.
John Heder, otherwise known as Napoleon Dynamite.
He's basically retired. Yeah.
Basically. Yeah. Or I've got two other weird ones to throw out there. Elijah Wood. Or here's a great one, Topher Grace.
Oh, man. As soon as you mention Topher Grace, I'm in because I just love him.
Where has he been? This would be a great role, a little weird role for him to play.
I don't think of like characters that I can think of that just kind of look sickly.
And then I would, for Julianne Moore, I would get someone like in the same age bracket is Natalie Portman, Scarlett Johansson, and as I mentioned before, Mary Elizabeth Winstead. They're all that. They could carry that sort of pretentious artist air, especially Natalie Portman would be great in that role.
There's my reboot. There you go. I'd watch it, especially with... Nick Offerman involved.
Yeah.
But I even think that Dave Harbour could play the dude.
You reckon?
Yeah, I reckon he could.
Hopper as the dude.
I reckon he could channel that.
I mean, he was a bit disheveled like in the first season. You know?
Yeah. Yep. He has his moments.
There you go. Thanks for that, DJ. we're coming to a close. I've got a couple of useless trivia notes here. 260 F-bombs in The Big Lebowski.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of swear words.
It's still only like top 30 as far as the record goes. But
Sam Elliott's just like, don't cuss. So
I thought of DJ at that moment.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Sam. DJ's been the champion of the bleep the swear words on your podcast brigade. So
that's me.
This might be one of the first podcasts to do that.
Oh, really?
Yep. What, on the collective?
Oh, well, just the first episodes on this podcast.
Okay. Sammy, get all of them out now.
Get them all out.
I mean, we only bleep the C word on our one.
Okay,
so we still have to best that out.
Speaking of like bleeping and censoring, I love this little tidbit.
Oh, I know exactly what you're about to say.
Do you see what happens when you find a stranger in the Alps?
Fantastic. That,
that's the like TV / like aeroplane edit of the F stranger in the A. scene when he's smashing up the car with the golf club.
Oh my god.
Most creative, and apparently John Goodman came up with that himself.
It's hilarious because you can almost not even see his mouth moving when it's happening. They could have just cut the line altogether, but it makes no sense.
Yeah.
Find a stranger in the Alps. Okay.
Oh my god.
Fantastic.
That's such a crazy scene.
Another little trivia here. According to Joel Cohen. Is it Joel Cohen?
Yep.
Yeah.
Sure.
So the only time they gave direction to Jeff Bridges, he would come over at the beginning of each scene and say, do you think the dude burned one on the way over here? And they'd usually say yes. So Jeff would just go in the corner and like rub his eyes until they were bloodshot. I didn't notice it when I was watching the movie, but I think that's what makes it great is that it's just like a little touch that like adds to the overall
character. That leads to one of my favorite scenes where the dude finds the homework in the smash car, in his smash car. And you have that scene where he's scanning the homework, looking at all the notes, and you get these closer up shots of his eyes where he's looking and he's got these big blue, and you're like, oh my goodness, he's got big blue eyes. You never really see his eyes the entire film. They're always squinty and red. But phenomenal. And here's another great trivia. Every scene in the movie, maybe bar one, there's a contention about one scene. Every scene has the dude in it.
Yeah, I read that today as well.
Jeff Bridges is in every scene. Like even
he's in the background in a car when the nihilists are talking in the cafe.
Yeah, that type of thing. There's a couple of moments where you're like, really, you're going to let that slip? But he's either, you know, in the background, in the foreground or something of every scene, every plot point in that movie, it revolves around the dude.
I would say apart from the tumbleweed at the start of the movie.
That's the dude, man. He is the tumbleweed.
There you go. So the Steve Buscemi Sparkplug Award, the nominees are Sam Elliott as The Stranger, John Turturro as Jesus. I had Philip Seymour Hoffman on this because I just don't think he does too much to be discounted. Tara Reid's in it very shortly. Peter Stormare as the nihilist that gets the most lines. I'm not going to give Flea a shout out here because I don't know if he says anything.
He does. He's great.
He screams pretty well when he gets hit in the guts with a bowling ball.
Oh my god! Yeah.
But who do you guys think deserves this honor of being the spark plug?
What's the spark award specifically?
So
for the audience,
someone that comes in and they just light it up while they're on screen, but they don't have like a they're not going to be nominated for best supporting actor. They're not carrying a lot of the burden.
It's just
a little shout out to those guys.
I reckon Philip Seymour Hoffman did a really good job as kind of, you know, this really kind of like doting, like trying to be friendly, but also, you know, it's like, oh, please, would you just call us back? I mean, it's just, we just need what, like one little thing. And, you know, you can just imagine, you know, the Big Lebowski just standing behind him. Have you got him yet for me? Yeah.
I just love like every scene that he's in. Like I'm enamored. So I that's my pick just because, like, you just want more of him. Like, I just wanted more of him.
Brand.
And he does such a great job in comedic roles. Like, he is someone, as I mentioned before, he's known for his drama. But, you know, Along Came Polly, he's really great in that movie as, like, a very different kind of character for him. And in this movie, again, like, I don't know who else could have pulled it off in quite the way that he did this.
No.
But does Sam Elliott have a case?
Yeah, Sam Elliott as the Stranger is the most inspired casting of all time. He's amazing in that voice,
his voice,
the look, the cowboy, you know.
He just wandered on set one day.
Apparently he was like confused as to why they cast him in this movie.
Yeah.
But did you get like Bastion vibes? Do you feel like that game was influenced by the voiceover?
I mean,
it's a trope,
I'm not sure if... I'd say it's more kind of... I mean, I'd argue it's almost more Morgan Freeman inspired, you know, in Bastion.
Sure, yeah. You know, it is an African-American voiceover in the video game Bastion for DJ wondering what we're talking about over there.
Yeah, I'm just quiet. I'm over here. I don't know what you're talking about.
Does Jesus get...
He's fun. And as far as defining a spark plug, he is the spark plug. Yeah. It's just crazy. I don't know. I'm such a fan of the narrator there, the stranger, the cowboy who comes in. He's great.
This is a hotly contested one, but I think Philip Seymour Hoffman wins.
Oh!
Rest in peace, you know.
Yes.
The late, great.
Worthy.
And yet again, Steve Buscemi not winning his own award. But his day... day will come.
You didn't even list him.
Oh, did I not say him?
You didn't list him at all.
I mean...
He wasn't even nominated.
Oh, there you go.
I don't know. As I said, I felt bad for him, especially with all these theories of like, he doesn't even exist. He didn't die. He was never alive to begin with.
Closing out the Big Lebowski podcast, is it still a good movie?
I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
100%. It's amazing, this film. Highly recommend it.
I agree. I think that unlike some of the other ones we've talked about on this podcast, it's easy to recommend this to someone who hasn't seen it, whether they're of our age, of younger generations. If someone was like 16 and interested in, you know, film history, I would tell them to watch this. If they're a comedy buff, I don't think you need to understand what it was like in the 90s. Mm. It's not a movie like a Billy Madison that you watch and you're like, it was...
Why weren't they paying Fortnite?
It worked at the time. It doesn't really work. It doesn't. There's none of that. It just works because it's these guys who have a pedigree of like Oscar movies deciding to do a comedy. And the cinematographer for this movie as well, we haven't really talked about, I guess, the technical aspect, but he is a guy that has like won so many Oscars for working with the Coen brothers and doing these like masterpieces and applying that to a comedy, and the creativity that's on display from that perspective holds up well.
And we haven't really mentioned this. It's infinitely rewatchable because I think it's infinitely quotable. There's so many. Every time you watch the movie, a line will pop in your head and the next day it'll pop back in your head. Like for me, I was walking around today going, you want a toe? I'll get you a toe. Like the way that Walter, the way that Walter says that to, you know, to the dude.
You just apply it to like anything. Oh, you want chips? I'll get you chips.
Exactly. You know, or even Donnie's little, your phone's ringing, dude, as he's walking away. Little moments like that. There's so many little lines that are just so well placed and so well acted that they just, it's all perfect for me.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that's kept it relevant is just dudes like you probably quoting it at parties.
Yeah, nerds. Nerds like me.
Deej, what do you reckon? It obviously.
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic movie. I think, you know, I was somewhat joking when I was like, oh, yeah, it's very intellectual, but it kind of is. Mm. Like it is kind of such an interesting, you know, look at this, you know, crazy, awful kind of swirl of stuff going around this guy. And I think, you know, it is kind of very relatable to people for that reason, that kind of, you know, feel like there are all these crazy forces around them controlling them.
Yeah.
But it's also very funny. And there's also, you know, a guy smashing up a car with a crowbar and saying, you know, this is what happens when you find people in the Alps or something. you know. Yeah. Like there's so much like frustration that I'm just like, yeah, I kind of feel that. I kind of feel like, you know, wanting to go crazy about that and or just, you know, walk around in a bathrobe and drink alcoholic drinks just on the reg.
We haven't even mentioned the White Russians yet at all. No. The dude's drink.
Sarsaparilla though.
You've got your sarsaparilla there, Sammy. Yeah.
Sammy's appropriately dressed in dressing gown just for this occasion.
Yeah. And you brought one and then you never wore it. You just left it in the car.
It's because it's pink and it's my wife.
And again. Then why did you even bring it?
Just in case DJ brought one and I didn't want to be the only one left out.
I don't have
so instead, now I'm the only one left in.
So you're the only one cool enough to pull it off. Let's put it that way. But I mean, I feel like compared to the other films we've talked about on this podcast where, you know, we're talking about movies that are headlined by these A-list blockbuster comedians, Mike Myers, Jim Carrey's, Adam Sandler's, this movie isn't attempting to draw in everybody. I think that's probably why it didn't make a lot of money. I think that's why it's become more popular over time. Mm. It's not a movie for everyone, but I think that if everyone gets around to, like, it's not marketed to everyone, but if everyone gets around to watching it, I think that it's pretty damn enjoyable.
Yeah.
I
love it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, that was Comedy Rewind. Of course, the iTunes reviews go a long way to helping us get the word out there, keeping the White Russians poured and ice cubes in the glasses. You can do that on iTunes or Podchaser, and of course I want to hear your questions, comments, and corrections about The Big Lebowski. Let me know what you think, and if I get enough feedback, I'll record a follow-up mini-episode to respond in the weeks between new episodes. So you can do that by hitting me up on social medias. I'm at Jono himself. DJ, where can people find you?
DJ Payne with an E on the end. P-A-I-N-E. DJ Payne. I'm that on everything.
Fantastic. Even MySpace.
Yep, I am. You joke, but I am. Yeah. DJ Payne on everything. Twitter, Instagram, wherever you want to find me.
Sammy Deej.
Well, yeah, my main thing is SammyDege on Twitter, which is spelled SammyDege. Yeah, and I post about all the awesome things, including stuff I put, like videos for 8-bit and stuff.
Yeah, and Inconsolables is your video game podcast.
Yeah.
It comes out every Tuesday,
and we have also got episode 150 will either coming out, depending on when this is coming out.
This isn't coming out for a while.
Okay, well, it happened a while ago, and I hope you tuned in. Otherwise, I'm very disappointed in you.
Go back and listen to episode 150.
Yeah.
And dear listeners, thank you, of course, for joining us on Comedy Rewind. As always, be kind and abide.